I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm at my allotment. That's right. I now grow vegetables and have bonfires and order cubic tons of manure. It's probably only a matter of time until I start drinking real ale, wearing cargo shorts and playing a hurdy-gurdy. I have been digging in some manure to try and loosen up my soil, found lots of worms. Been burning a whole load of stuff that was left over from the last owner, and hoping that I'm not about to uncover a rat's nest at every turn. That's the thing that I'm most scared of. My guest this week on the podcast is the journalist, filmmaker, and dad who gave birth, Freddie McConnell. Freddie has a column in Vice about being a trans dad, and he made a beautiful film called Seahorse, all about how he became a father. And he has his own podcast called Pride and Joy, all about queer families, which I loved. Sometimes I think, and I really hope this isn't reductive, but I have said it to Freddie myself, sometimes I think of Freddie as my dad counterpart, because we first met about 6 years ago when we were both in Melbourne and both having a small freak out about who we were and what we were doing. We've then gone on to write for lots of the same places, and now we both have blonde sons who are almost exactly the same age. But while we carried our children at the same time and both gave birth in pools and both wrote about it, as a queer parent, Freddie's taught me loads about that whole experience that I may have never understood on my own. So I loved talking to him about his panic years and about being a single dad and how many of us have just been misinformed about fertility. Also, stick around after the interview because I'll be talking to Jay Stewart from Gendered Intelligence to get some really helpful expert insight into gender and what the hell it is. How are you? And how is your body?
I am well. I'm a bit tired, still waking up. And my body is something that I'm trying not to think about very much currently.
It's such a huge question for everybody, but for you, it feels like I've really gone straight in there.
Yeah, that's kind of why.
To the jugular.
That's why I said that. It's like, it's just easier not to think about because it's quite complicated. Oh God, I mean, where to start? If you'd have asked me that 3 years ago when I was off testosterone for the first time to try to have my first kid, I'd have probably just burst into tears, or, you know, I probably actually wouldn't have been able to talk about it. I probably wouldn't be making, I wouldn't be talking to you. But now, 3 years later, for a variety of reasons, it feels a lot easier and just a lot more exciting. And yeah, I'm able to focus on the positives. But, you know, the physical dysphoria is definitely still there. It's more just like it's easier to ignore.
How many months have you been off testosterone?
Since April, so
quite
a long time.
And we're talking in December.
Yeah.
So that's enough time for all sorts of things to roar up.
Yeah, although, like, I mean, it is probably worth saying that, like, it's all the changes, I think, that happen when you stop testosterone for an extended period of time are really only noticeable to you, to oneself. So that's helpful, and I'm trying to trust that more. And yes, be less sort of paranoid. And it's this weird way in which COVID has actually been sort of a blessing in disguise for me, just for me, you know, in a very sort of selfish sense. I realize it's so weird to say that. And I always feel a bit uncomfortable saying that, but it's true. It just means that I haven't had to really be in the world as much. And I've had a good excuse to avoid social interactions. And, you know, first time around, it was being at work in the office when I used to work in a big office. Every day was a massive struggle.
Right.
And I just don't have to do that anymore. So that's helpful.
Can I just check? The reason that you're off testosterone at the moment and you came off testosterone before, it's because you are in the beginning stages of a sort of fertility journey, to put it that way. You're trying to have a baby. Yeah. I don't know why I'm being so sort of mealy mouthed about it.
You used the journey word.
I know. Gross. Yeah. But you are trying to get up the spout.
Yes. not to put too fine a point on it. It is already taking a bit longer than it did the first time around, because this time when I had my first child, I was thinking of co-parenting in the beginning, and then I sort of went into it as just a single parent by choice, and I did IUI, mm-hmm. so insemination, basically, like fairly straightforward. I did it at a clinic rather than at home, the DIY option. But this time around, I'm actually doing mild IVF, which is, I think, the main reason it's taking a bit longer. Ah. And there's just various... Even though it's taking longer, I wanted to create embryos because I felt like overall that would have a better chance of working in a shorter time frame than the uncertainty of just mm-hmm. doing a simple insemination wasn't something I was going to subject myself to again. And actually I now mm-hmm. have those embryos, and so the next stage will be sort of actually trying to conceive.
The single parent by choice sort of path, I think, is so interesting, because for me, a huge part of what was making me panic during the panic years was this feeling that I had to get certain parts of my life, quote unquote, sorted, whatever the hell that meant, before I got pregnant. And one of those things for me was to be in a relationship. And obviously, I knew loads of people who were parenting in different ways, on their own or not with someone they're in a relationship with. But I still had it in my head that I needed to find a partner, and that partner needed to be the father of my child. I wondered if for you, separating a relationship from parenthood, did that sort of alleviate the panic, or was it a decision that was made for different reasons?
Yeah, I think it just, for me, so before, when you were talking about what makes lockdown hard, and you said that you really miss hugging people and you really miss seeing people, like, I don't miss hugging people. I've never, that's just not really something that I need. And I'm also a massive introvert, and I'm quite sort of, I'm quite aromantic. I am totally aromantic. So I think in a way it wasn't a conscious decision to become a single parent by choice. It just always felt like what I would probably end up doing, and something that to me felt like totally fine.
Wow.
Not positive or negative, just like, well, yeah, that's fine. That's an option. Like, I did explore the idea of co-parenting with a couple of people, but like, it just didn't work, like, for no particular reason, not because I'm aromantic or because I definitely wanted to just parent by myself, but various like complicated, messy human reasons why lots of relationships don't work out. And again, it wasn't like coming out of that I decided, oh, I definitely am going to parent by myself.
Yeah.
You know, the decision to start with my family when I did was informed hugely in the early days by my fear that my testosterone treatment would eventually make me infertile. I was told when I started testosterone therapy back in 2013, or I wasn't told, but I had to sign a consent form. And part of one of the lines of the consent form was that I understood that I would no longer be able to have biological children. And no one really like went into much detail about that. It was briefly mentioned that I might want to consider freezing my eggs, which I now know is, there's such a low chance of a success with frozen eggs that I'm kind of annoyed that I was even given that advice, even though that was the only advice about fertility that I was given.
My God.
So yeah, I spent like a few years thinking that I couldn't anymore have biological children and I would just start my family in a different way. And, you know, even if I wasn't infertile, the idea of being pregnant, I sort of thought that I had to transition in a certain way because that's what I was told by the gender mm-hmm. clinic, and that's the only representation of transness I really had at that point, or any of us in the community had at that point. Like, we're still learning about ourselves and about the possibilities out there for us, I think, as trans people, because for so long we've been restricted by how society sees us and the way it's all framed very negatively, and it's all kind of about shame and sort of quote unquote full transition and becoming a man and all those sorts of things.
This really strict binary that there is one form of being one gender and one form being the other gender, and you've got to pick one.
Yeah, exactly. That's just what you are told. And like, that's better than the alternative, which is not transitioning. Well, for me anyway, that's what it felt like. So I just didn't really question it. And I thought, well, I do need to do this. I do need to transition. I need to look after myself. If I don't do this, then if I can't like look after myself, I'm never going to be in a position to look after another human being. So like, that was a fairly easy equation for me, but I was sad about the idea of becoming infertile. So it's like a weird thing when you discover that's actually not true by watching a YouTube video with a trans guy who's pregnant. It's like amazing and infuriating at the same time. You know, you sort of think, why was I told that? How dare they? You know.
So there you are on YouTube, here's a latest funny video from somewhere. And here is something undermining everything you've been told about your ability to get pregnant. Was it an odd way for you to find out?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there was other stuff that like, I did know by that point that there's this sort of understanding in the UK among trans people that when you go to the gender clinic, you have to sort of perform a certain kind of transness in order to be approved maybe for treatment and you have to, like, I always remember feeling as though for my consultant at the gender clinic I went to, I was like a star pupil because I had a good full-time job and I liked watching cricket and I was just like a normal bloke. And so it really felt like that really kind of paternalistic worst aspects of the NHS type situation where they're being really gatekeepery and you just have to like play the game.
And to not push you too hard, but is part of being a typical bloke, do you think, being not that bothered about having children?
100%. Yeah, I was expected. Like, I think that's why they don't really go into much detail about it. There is no evidence that testosterone causes infertility. So the way it's almost like they kind of want you to believe that that's the case. But actually what they just are assuming is that you'll stay on testosterone. And when you're on testosterone, you can get pregnant, but you shouldn't because it's harmful to a developing fetus. It's like this really complicated combination of things where they're not telling you explicitly that it's going to make you sterile forever, but that is it's very much implied. And also what's implied is that there is this, it shouldn't matter to you anyway, because if you're a man, then you certainly shouldn't want to become pregnant. And you also just shouldn't really just care about kids that much either, because that's not manly. It took me 2 years on testosterone to where I felt really much more confident in my own skin and in myself, and much more like I was really to be assertive in what I wanted and how I understood myself. And so it's kind of funny, like a paradox of like, I am the man I feel I am now, and I can go back to the gender clinic and say to this consultant, actually, I'm going to start a family and I'm considering pregnancy. And his jaw just dropped. And I went from being this star pupil to a weirdo in like a second. He just kind of got all flustered and said something like, well, I've never heard of that happening before, which just cannot be true. And he discharged me. But I knew at that point that like the decision to be pregnant or to become pregnant was pragmatic for me. It wasn't a gender thing at all. It was just like the simplest and safest way I could figure out to become a parent. And the biological link was also important to me, but really like the pragmatic side of it was my main motivation. But this doctor just couldn't get his head around that and how I could be a man but also want kids. So he discharged me, which meant I didn't have any access to any of the sort of mental health support that I might have really benefited from while I was pregnant, because I wasn't going to go down the kind of set pathway of then having lower surgery, which is what you're expected to do. That he had nothing more to say to me, kind of thing.
Being discharged like that, did you feel at all like you were being punished for doing something differently to what they wanted or what they expected?
I mean, I definitely felt like I was doing something that was really taboo, and I felt I was just like amazed that that was his reaction. And but it was only later that I realized I think the kind of dereliction of duty in actually discharging me. At the time, I just felt like, okay, discharge me then, whatever. Like, I don't really need specifically your support, clearly, because I'm not going to get that. So that's fine. And yeah, it was only after I sort of thought, actually discharging me, I don't know. That was really unhelpful. But what was also weird about it was that another doctor at the same clinic then continued seeing me at a different sort of NHS site, because he was totally fine with it. And he was like, yeah, this happens. Wow. And this is what you need to do. And he supported me through the whole process. So
amazing.
You know, thank God for him. But also it just shows like how silly it is. It just comes down to sort of so much of that healthcare is informed by personal opinion about what gender means. It's scary. Yeah.
And in a very Freddie McConnell pragmatic, aromantic way, you've written before about how you just had the hardware to get pregnant. Yeah. You just had it there. And so it seemed like that was a pragmatic decision, that that you kind of could do it on your own. Do you feel like that this time round? Or now that you've been pregnant, does it feel like a different... It's not just that you've got the hardware and this is a quick way to do it. It's that you want to be pregnant again or not?
I guess those things don't necessarily feel mutually exclusive to me. Uh-huh. I think if anything, it's not like, yeah, when I use words like hardware and pragmatic, like I know to some people that can just sound like I'm trying to emotionally separate myself from the process. And I'm really not. Mm. Like hardware to me isn't like, I guess it's what some people get really upset by the use of terms like pregnant people. And sometimes that's disingenuous and it's about transphobia. And other times I genuinely think it is a kind of slight aversion to what can sound like maybe dehumanizing language, even though obviously people isn't dehumanizing. It's like it's by definition human, but it takes away some of the emotion from it. And I think people hear that when I use a word like hardware, and I'm really not like to me, it's a neutral description. I'm being really honest about my body. I'm not trying to deny anything. I guess it does make me feel more comfortable to use words like that, but that's just my subjective experience.
You're hardly the only person in the world who is comfortable with certain language describing their body, you know? And yeah. Like we all,
that's a good point.
We're all, lots of people are euphemistic about all sorts of things like their menstrual cycle or their body shape or, you know, the processes that we go through. That's completely universal, I think. We don't, otherwise we would have one word for everything.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I'm not also trying to avoid talking about uteruses and vulvas, even all those sorts of things. I just, the way I see it, I'm just trying to explain the way I kind of, yeah, see it. And I like it. So for me, I think maybe a useful thing to put it in context with is like, well, most trans men, most of whom don't become pregnant and don't go down that route to parenthood, most of us don't have lower surgery. People ask me things like, how do you feel doing this like ultimate female experience? Right. And I understand the question, but I also think it's a really good example of how cis people just do not understand what it means to be trans. Like it is not a female experience for me. What makes it hard for me is when other people see it exclusively as that, and the world of pregnancy care and maternity care is all about women. And that's what makes me feel excluded and it makes it a struggle, not the subjective experience, if that makes sense.
Entirely for my own wish fulfillment, can you say, which is something I've heard you written down, but I've never heard you actually say, is of course men can get broody and of course men can want children. Because I very, very, very rarely hear men say that, cis men, heterosexual men in my immediate
circle.
Of course
you don't. Like, that's the that's the tragedy of like, because yes, absolutely, I think men do get broody and men do really want children and really want families and they want to be dads, but they can't talk about it. And to me, the reasons for that are really obvious, in the same way that the reasons for why, you know, men commit sexual assault and men do not cry and men have higher rates of suicide. I don't understand again why parenting and fatherhood is left out of this conversation about what effects toxic masculinity is having on men, including trans men, and those knock-on effects to wider society. I'm not saying lots of cis men talk about wanting children. I'm saying they don't talk about it, and that is a massive problem and a tragedy. And it means I really feel for all the cis dads out there who are missing out on the closeness to their children that they could have, because they don't even realize they could have it. Either they do feel like they could have it and they're afraid to explore it, or they're limited by their work or they're so far gone down the kind of route of like, this is what being a man is, that they actually don't have access to those emotions and that intimacy anymore. So they don't even realize what they're missing out on. And I just, you see it anecdotally with men, I do often, and you also see it, you know, if you want to kind of look at it anthropologically speaking, there are tribes where parenting is done equally and babies suckle at their father's chest for comfort. And the difference between that society and ours is that there is no loss of status for the men doing that in that tribe in the Congo versus here, where there is a massive loss of status for men being emotional and intimate and then therefore being sort of involved fathers. I just like, it's a societal problem. It's not to do, it's not biological. That's bullshit.
It's so hard for me to talk about. It's the missing bit in this conversation. You're quite right. We, you know, that we don't allow that space for men to be broody until they've had children. And like, why, you know, why do they have to wait until they've got one before they can act like dads?
And then like, and then the assumption that they might be a bit useless, or they might be this and that kind of thing. It's just like, it doesn't make sense to me, especially because to me, it's just the flip side. You see this in the context of like, we are now at a stage mostly where we understand that not all women do feel broody. Not all women want to become parents, and the idea of a biological
determination.
Yeah, it's all just so gross and outdated, and we've left all that behind mostly, thankfully. Where's the other half of it? It's totally missing. It's like, what? I'm not an expert on this stuff. I don't want to sound as though I've got it all figured out. I only had this realization for myself fairly recently when some friends of a friend who are a cis straight couple, it just so happened that because she had a business, the mum was going out to work still and the dad was like in between jobs. So he was being the full-time parent. I'll never forget my friend telling me that when she went round there for tea, the father, he just knew, like they were going to go out to the park or something. And the mum was like, I don't know. And the dad was like, well, she did this at this time and this at that time. And so she'll need this and this and that. Mm. And there was no, it's just because he's there. It's just because he's the full-time parent. It's like, it's got nothing to do with your gender or your sex.
Yeah.
You are in sync with the child if you are with them all the time. There's no like essential motherly instinct in that. It's just practical.
Yeah. In the same way that there has to be a certain climb down from men in some contexts, there has to be a certain climb down from women in others. I do have to sort of climb down from the idea that I'm in any way innately better placed to care for my son than my partner is. Why? You know, he's way beyond breastfeeding now. There's nothing that I can offer him that my partner can't. Mm. So this idea, the sort of primary caregiver, mother, goddess thing, I have to let that go. And that's what equality looks like sometimes. It means losing your special status.
Yeah, but it's much easier. I understand why, as a society, we have told ourselves this story in the same way that we tell ourselves that girls like certain toys and boys like other toys. Like, it's much easier to tell ourselves that than to unpick what's really going on here. It's much easier to just say, oh, well, mothers are better at being the primary caregivers because of some innate magical woo-woo thing, as opposed to it's the patriarchy. But then again, like maybe because of the way people are socialized, because of the way that boys are taught to shut down their emotions from a very early age, maybe there is a way in which, you know, one given mother and one given father are better at being parents. Like, I don't want to say that you can just plonk any old man in a room or any old woman. Like, you know, I just...
That's a shame, because that sounded like a great nursery. You just plonk any man in a room with a load of children and he'll eventually find how to do it.
Well, he probably will. But like, you know, it's part of the bigger issue of like the reason that we're not going to have great involved dads until we fix out like the bigger problems to do with, you know, all the kind of misogyny and sexism in society. It's not an easy fix. I just think it's like there are some glaring omissions here when we talk about what the damage that toxic masculinity does.
I think I am guilty, absolutely guilty, of sometimes being quite negative about the experience of parenting and pregnancy, because I have this, I don't know why, like intrinsic desire to bang at the door of a sort of goddessy, Instagram friendly, idealistic view of what those things are. And so I often talk about the sort of the stress and the loneliness and the smells and all of that stuff. And you quite rightly picked me up when I sent over a list of subjects by saying, for you, single queer parenting is a really joyful experience. And in your brilliant podcast, you Pride and Joy, which I completely loved, you introduced me to loads of families that were also joyful. And there is difficulty in there too. But I wanted you to sort of talk about, basically, as a counterpoint to my moaning mini, for you, it feels like an investment in the future. It feels like something that brings a huge amount of satisfaction and love and happiness into your life.
Yeah. One of the reasons I've sort of quite enjoyed lockdown in some ways is because it reminds me of early parenthood. It takes me back to that time when life just felt a lot simpler. We could just sort of bunker down and do puzzles and whatever and not have to be racing out the house. And I still find leaving the house really difficult, like in terms of like, do I have all the stuff that I need?
And you can do that, just you and them one-on-one. You can, and that you don't get claustrophobic, you don't get bored, or do you just feel the boredom and the claustrophobia in a different way?
Yeah, I do definitely get claustrophobic, but I suppose I don't feel the need to, when we're in the house together, we're not doing activities together a large part of the time. I would say often my kid is doing one thing and I'm doing another thing, or I'm getting sort of chores done. And I mean, I'm quite relaxed about telly. I would say if ever I feel like this tension in the house is rising, I would rather just get rid of that tension by like doing something that I know is going to be relaxing for both of us rather than sort of try to push through or worry about it too much. So yeah, I guess I have quite a laissez-faire approach to all that sort of thing. And I'm not, if I was like, I'm not sitting here saying I'm like playing games with my child 10 hours a day. No, that is definitely not happening. And often I will have the radio on or I'll have a podcast on. So even if we are hanging out together, I will have something to just slightly engage that other bit of my brain at the same time. So like, and we don't, you know, my kid, I don't know, maybe I'm just lucky. Like my kid's not interested in like baking yet. I'm sure he will be maybe at some point. But if I was like laying on activities and stuff, I just know he wouldn't particularly want to do that. He wants to play with his dinosaurs and do puzzles and read a book occasionally. So I'm not having like thing after thing just break down into tantrums and stress on my part because I don't even bother doing it in the first place. That's my secret.
I have like even have this phrase that I see creep into my writing where I talk about the stress of being a single parent. On what grounds am I saying that? Because I'm not one, and so I don't know.
Well,
if it is stressful.
It's funny. I mean, maybe it's just your perspective. It's just at one's perspective, because I sort of feel like I can hear that there is more stress in being a mother in this age of Instagram than there is being a queer parent, however one identifies, because I sort of feel liberated. Like I make sure that my Instagram feed is not full of the perfect parenting guilt inducing stuff, and I think a lot of that isn't targeted at me anyway, so I'm not looking at people who are sort of setting completely unattainable goals or, you know, standards and feeling guilt about it, because I know that's not me. You know, it's sort of maybe it's easier to exist outside of that. And
yeah,
obviously there are other obstacles, like having to go to court to be recognized in your child's birth certificate. But in a way, it's easier to just do your own thing and carve your own path, I think, as a queer parent.
And as a sort of politically engaged, ecologically engaged queer parent, just to get everything in there, you say something that I found really moving, which is that you think having children is a way of fighting for the future. Is that how you'd always felt?
Yeah, I definitely always knew I was going to have kids somehow. And I, you know, when I thought I was going to be infertile, that would be adoption or possibly surrogacy. I didn't, and I don't necessarily equate having kids being an investment in the future with having new children. I don't want that to seem as though like that's the better option in any way over other kinds of family creation. And I also don't feel like it's linked to my personal choices, as it were. Like it kind of is. It does inform my personal choice and the way I feel about my child and my family. But also I wouldn't want it to come across as any kind of admonishment of people who choose not to have children. I'm not saying each individual has a duty to do XYZ at all, but for me, it's more on a theoretical level of I've just never really understood the mindset of, well, I'm not going to have kids because the future is so bleak that I can't even bear the thought of it. Like, that's just not how I feel. Right. At one point, I watched not a TED talk, but it was something similar to that about how overpopulation is a myth. And so ever since then, I've thought, you know, this idea that there's too many people on the planet is sort of deeply racist and problematic, and also just like not true on a numbers level, because birth rates have been declining for many, many years. And like, we're going to reach, you know, the point at which the population is no longer growing fairly quickly. It's not happened yet because of there's a lag in these things. And but like, there isn't too many people. There's a completely unequal distribution of resources, you know.
Yeah, it's a really pernicious smokescreen for what we actually should be talking about, which is overconsumption. It's not overpopulation.
Yeah.
And overconsumption is actually a problem of the sort of economically developed countries that they will not shoulder. Yeah. George Monbiot says this great thing when I interviewed him. He said, there are two solutions to overpopulation, fertility and longevity. But whenever I say that to a 60-year-old white man, he doesn't seem to want to take any action on it, which is very good.
Yeah.
But yeah, for you, there is a strong argument that actually your act of making a family is a positive act, a light into what's coming.
It's more like... more of a pragmatic thing of like, it's not that I want to have a family, it's that people are going to keep having children.
Right.
Full stop. So like, I think it feels odd for an individual to think that what they do has any bearing on anything. So like, if you want to have kids, don't see it as something that's going to have an impact on the future of humanity. You know, you can raise kids that are conscious and will be valuable future citizens, because there will be future citizens. People are not just going to stop having children, and by not having children, equally, you are not having any impact on the future of humanity. To me, it just feels kind of weirdly grandiose to think that like anything that we do as individuals is going to affect anything. And we need to be pushing governments to be creating political change. You know, like, it's a bit like sort of guilting someone into turning the taps off or turning the lights off, as if that's going to have, or like doing their recycling diligently, because that's just a massive distraction from the bigger problem for me. So like, if you want to have kids, have kids. If you don't have kids, don't have kids. Don't pretend to yourself that any of that is going to have a big impact on the bigger picture, but just like, do whatever you're going to do as ethically as you can. And then on another level, this is just me, I do feel quite optimistic about what that means. I think it's really important that if you have kids and you raise them to be conscious and politically engaged, and I see that as it can be a contribution to the future. It might not be, like, I'm not going to say like I know exactly what I'm doing, but I just hope it can be, and I see good reasons for why it could be, I suppose.
So we're not claiming, you and I, that our two white-headed children are going to solve climate change, which is a shame because it would be great if they could.
I mean, you know, one can hope.
Thank you so much to Freddie McConnell for such a great chat and for sitting under a blanket during the whole thing, which both improved the sound quality and made it feel a little bit like we were having a weird sleepover. such is the nature of recording from home. After talking to Freddie, I wanted to find out more about the difference between sex, which is what the World Health Organization defines as a biological set of characteristics, and gender, which is a social construct. So I spoke to the CEO of Gendered Intelligence, Jay Stewart. Gendered Intelligence offer training and support for organisations and individuals who just want to think more intelligently about gender. They do amazing work. Check them out. Back when I was a lifeguard at the Kenwood Ladies Pond, I had brilliant training with Gendered Intelligence. All the lifeguards did. And it was a real treat to talk to Jay and to share his insight. Enjoy. My first question, which is both sort of huge and apparently quite obvious, is what is gender, Jay Stewart? What is gender?
Gosh, yeah, no, that is a good one and difficult to actually sum up in a pithy way. gender is part of a person's identity, which manifests in and through society in rich and complex and political ways, I would say. We are given a sex and a gender at birth, and I suppose it's interesting to think about what part of an individual is given and determined, and what part of an individual is self-recognized and develops through lived experience. And I think gender plays out across those two types of beingness in complicated ways. It's a tricky one to actually respond to.
Well, I remember when I did a gendered intelligence bit of training, something that we sort of talked about was, it was like the very basic question of like, what is a man? Mm. And someone said, they have hair on their face, they have a deep voice, they don't have breasts. And, you know, these sort of rattled off these things. And quite rightly, we then said, but what if you've had a mastectomy, you have polycystic ovarian syndrome, you have a deep voice, like you could still be and identify and be identified by others as a woman and bear all those hallmarks, so-called gender sort of markers that we associate with men. And I think it's that, isn't it? Hair, shape, voice, dress, you know, kind of work you do are all markers of gender, not of sex. Is that right?
There's a few different theories. And you're right that there are a range of indicators or signifiers or cues that alert us to a person's gender. And I think the accumulative kind of aspect of those signifiers make a person deem that person in which they kind of have in front of them as a particular gender. And there is something else to gender, isn't there? So in and of themselves, those singular aspects of gender expression are not enough to tell us about the identity of that person. I suppose we're in an era where we're saying there's something that comes from a kind of self-recognition or a set of internal ideas of sense of self, which then speak to those gender expressions. Or do the gender expressions make us up? I suppose it's kind of both. Does that make sense? It's really...
It makes total sense, because you may have all these signifiers and the gender that you identify with is more than the sum of those parts, or maybe unrelated to those parts. You know, you may, in my case, have certain physical attributes or social attributes or vocal attributes, whatever. But the way I identify my gender is something that is the sort of conclusion I have come to as a result of the way I feel in myself and feel in the world. And that's actually the case for everyone, trans, cisgendered. Our gender is something that we have collated from internal signifiers, external signifiers, and the way we interact in the world.
It's about where are you feeling most settled or comfortable, or where are the points at which things feel wrong or unsafe, lack opportunity or restrict and constrain you in your life? How can we as a society open up that space so that there is more freedom for everybody to reach that point at which they're kind of happy with, I suppose. From a kind of feminist point of view, it's making me think what you're saying. You know, I remember someone saying to me, who wants to be a woman in a patriarchal society?
You know? Who would pick team B?
yeah. So it's complicated, isn't it? Because there is a politic, there is power, there is history where, you know, male society has deemed women and girls as objects and property in the past. Obviously, lots has changed, but there's still a lot to do in terms of the way in which women and girls are positioned in society and what options they have. So I think our ideas around trans experience needs to fit into that wider piece around gender equality as well, I think.
Talking about the opportunities that are sort of made available or made comfortable or made safe to us, I wanted to talk to you particularly about trans and non-binary and gender diverse parenting, because I think that's something that even someone like me or one of my peers who might consider themselves fairly conscious and engaged with trans issues, we might not know many trans parents, you know, we might not know many gender diverse parents. Do you have any idea how many trans, non-binary or gender diverse parents there are in the UK?
No, that's a really good one. I know about three. Well, there's all sorts of reasons why parents, trans people who are parents, hide. Every trans parent that I know has their own story. And so there's lots of inroads, like all people into parenthood, there's lots of ways into that. There's lots of trans men, I think, who have got pregnant and gave birth, who are not and have not disclosed their trans status to any of the services that they've encountered through maternity and postnatal treatment or whatever it's called. I think there is still an appetite from maternity services to support trans men who are, or trans masculine and non-binary people who are getting pregnant. So that's opening up. So I think we'll see more numbers around people who are pregnant. There are trans people who have transitioned after having children and being a parent, and that's reasonably common. I think not reasonably common, but probably the most common story around being a parent, you know, kind of transitioning later on in life and coming out to your own children effectively and telling them that you're going to transition or that you identify as trans.
You're so right. Yeah, I automatically, you know, as in the case of the Brighton and Hove sort of changes in wording, I automatically think of trans parents as people who are presenting as trans at the point of pregnancy. What can this is a tricky one. What can trans or non-binary families and parents offer that maybe cisgendered parents find trickier or less innate or less obvious?
Well, that is a good question. My view is that we can learn a lot from trans people who are parents, says the person who is one. So here we go. But there's a big thing for me around roles still in society. So there's a lot of heterosexual couples still reinforcing those expectations around who does the child care, who mows the lawn, who takes the bins out, all of those things. And, you know, in my relationship, and I know in a lot of LGBT kind of relationships, that's all up for grabs. It's like, hey, what do you mind doing? What don't you really want to do? Like, I'm all right with that. I'll do the cooking. That's cool. I don't mind doing most of the cooking, but every now and again, I think you should do some. Like, it's all up for negotiation, and we can play to our strengths and our interests. I mean, I don't think everyone's interested in, you know, house cleaning or anything like that. But
oh, I'm so interested in hoovering. No, but you make a good point then, that if everyone's playing to their strengths, or at least leaning into their strengths, you will have people who are maybe more capable or at least more engaged. You know, like I think about this in so many relationships, that if it's just assumed that one of the parents will, by dint of their gender, be better at DIY, you might miss out on the fact that actually the other parent is much more capable or better placed or has more time or has more money or whatever in order to do that DIY. We lose the possibility of someone being better at a role because we've just defined it by gender from the off.
Absolutely. And I think it's still really difficult to be out as the person who is, you know, kind of not conforming to those gender norms. So if you've got a heterosexual couple and the man says to his friendship circle, actually, my partner does all of the DIY, that would still be quite a difficult thing to sort of be out and proud about, you know, and would have to have kind of some good confidence and not feel too, you know, peer pressured into being ashamed of that. I think shame's kind of really still massive, you know, around this stuff.
Yeah, but you're right that if there's a sort of vaccination against shame, if you are brought up in a trans or non-binary household, you know, that you will sort of, you won't grow up with the sense that something is illicit or not for you, hopefully, or slightly less, you know, because one day you're going to go to school and nursery and those things are going to come knocking at your door, but you've got a little bit of time. For someone like me who is cisgendered but will, you know, necessarily and want to interact with trans people in the world, what can I do to make life better, easier for them, as parents and just as people in the world?
Gosh, lots, basically, and keep going and keep learning and keep thinking, I suppose, is what my first response would be. As gender is expressed, you know, through the way that we look, the way that we carry ourselves, but also in the jobs that we do, the work that we do, the interest that we have, I think it's really important not to make any assumptions and to give people space and opportunity to say where they're coming from with regards to their gender identity, mm-hmm. you know, and that goes across the board, really. It's really important to talk to cis people about how they feel about their gender identity and kind of where they're up to. And, you know, when we deliver training, for example, there's always stories, people reflecting on their own lived experiences, whether they're trans or not, and mostly not, around how their own gender identity is also complicated. And they've had those experiences where they felt quite regulated and policed, if you like, by people outside. So just encouraging people to open up and to have the conversations, not making any assumptions, not restricting people, even by way of which you're not aware of. You know, how can we sort of be alerted to our blind spots? How can we surround ourselves by people who are going to tell us that kind of stuff? You know, when you did that, it made me actually feel like this. And for us to be like, thank you for telling me, you know, we can work together, let me think about shifting in my behavior, all of that. I mean, it's very broad, and I don't mean to be all vague and stuff, but I think it's really, really important.
No, it is. And it's, I think that you've just touched on something that I find such a fundamental sort of shift in the way you think about it. Is if someone points out something that you could be doing better, you should be grateful yeah. to them rather than feeling under attack. You know, like, someone is not telling you off. They're just letting you get better at the way you handle yeah. things. Now, in any other area of our life, we'd be quite pleased for that to happen. You know, if someone says, oh, actually, like, that's not how you do a 3-point turn, you wouldn't be like, how dare you? You know, and be like, oh, someone's going to show me how to park better. Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. I've actually just noticed that there's a bit of rhubarb unfurling over here near me, and that my neighbour now has enough onions to start quite a substantial market stall. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thank you so much to my guests, Freddie McConnell and Jay Stewart, for talking to me. Thank you to my producer, Rich Jarman, the kindest man in audio. And most of all, thank you to you for listening. Next week's guest is the comedian, filmmaker, bundle of fun and mother of one, Miss Josie Long. So please come back next Friday to hear me and Josie talking all about our panic years. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. It just makes a massive difference. It feels great. And like having a big stretch will cost you absolutely nothing. This is a brand new audio production.